That's correct.
May it please the court, Scott Craig on behalf of Great Dane Trailers. The jury's finding that Mr. Mack was mistakenly regarded as disabled was not supported by the evidence, and the district court erred when it denied Great Dane's renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law on this point. An employer cannot be said to mistakenly regard an employee as disabled if the employer's perception of that employee's limitations is based on the doctor's written restrictions. In this case, Great Dane made an individualized assessment of Mr. Mack's abilities and his limitations. This assessment was not based on myth, on some unsubstantiated belief, on stereotypes. Instead, it was based on the repeated written instructions of Mack's treating physician, a physician that Mr. Mack had treated with for 13 months, a neurosurgeon, who repeatedly stated in her written orders that Mr. Mack had restrictions that included no squatting. There was no mistake, no misperception on the part of Great Dane. Mr. Mack was not perceived as having any impairments that he did not, in fact, possess. Used the words mistake and misperception quite a bit this morning because those terms are derived from the United States Supreme Court's decision, Sutton versus United Airlines. In Sutton, the Supreme Court made it clear that to support a finding that an employer regards an employee as disabled, there must be some mistake, some misperception on the part of the employer. This standard comports with the purposes of the regarded as prong of the ADA to prevent or to require employers to make decisions about an employee based on the employee's actual attributes and not on speculation or stereotype. Mr. Mack's treating physician repeatedly stated that Mr. Mack had restrictions that included no squatting. Now, the brief we focused on lifting, because if you cannot squat, you cannot squat down to lift something up. The safe and proper way to pick up an object from below your waist, from the ground level, is to squat to initiate that lift, making you use your legs instead of your back to perform the lift. If you cannot squat, if your restriction is you are not to squat, as Dr. Schooler stated, then you cannot squat to pick up a heavy object from the floor without violating those restrictions. Great Dane did nothing more in this case than recognize Mr. Mack's restrictions and treat him accordingly. To hold an employer liable under these circumstances would put employers in a very difficult position. They could choose to honor the physician's restrictions and risk being held to regard the employee as disabled, or they can ignore the restrictions and put the employee back to work. Great Dane did the right thing in this case. It followed the doctor's orders. It believed what Dr. Schooler said and treated Mr. Mack accordingly. There was no mistake, and therefore there can be no holding that Mr. Mack was regarded as disabled. Beyond, I think, if we could even move beyond the issue of whether or not there was a mistake or a misperception on the part of Great Dane, there was insufficient evidence to find that Mr. Mack was substantially limited in the major life activity of lifting.
Is lifting a major life activity?
I believe that it is, Your Honor.
Under what authority?
The regulations implementing the ADA have always stated that lifting is a major life.
Those regulations survive Toyota against Williams?
Well, Toyota does not expressly overrule those regulations. I think it does call into question some of the regulations and whether they're empowered by Congress.
Toyota says that the critical question is whether the person has an impairment that prevents or severely restricts the individual from doing activities that are of central importance to most people's daily lives. Do you think lifting from below the waist meets that criterion?
No, I do not, Your Honor. There are occasions when, in the course of a day, when we may be asked to pick something up that's below our waist.
But anything heavier than a book, I don't do, but...
Well, that's the point, Your Honor.
It's one of the reasons I was attracted to the practice of law. It's so heavy lifting, and it's all indoors.
And then he was shocked when the Xerox company invented the plain paper copier, and lawyers were crushed in paper.
Never touch it myself.
Your Honor, you have picked up on, or you're discussing the exact issue that we've raised in our brief. Most of the lifting that we do some lifting day in and day out. We pick up books. We put things back on the shelf. We get the groceries out of the car. This is lifting, and it's important to our lives to be able to lift things. But the kind of lifting that Mr. Mack couldn't do is not that important. Yes, it would be an inconvenience to not be able to pick up the laundry basket off the floor. But it would not impact your daily life in the manner that is required by the Supreme Court's decision in Toyota.
But one would think that this entire case has been overtaken by Toyota. It's a little surprising that you're not relying on it heavily. Now, I understand your brief was written before Toyota came down, but there are procedures for bringing to our attention subsequent authority of major import.
We did file some supplemental briefs on Toyota.
Let me ask you this. Given Toyota, is it your view that to make out a claim that an employer regarded the plaintiff, this is the regarded as,
correct,
regarded the plaintiff as disabled, that the plaintiff would have to show what the employer believed with respect to his functioning outside the job?
Absolutely, and there was no evidence of that presented at trial.
And how do you think an employee would normally show that?
I think that they could simply, in a regarded as case, they would have to, during discovery, they could certainly depose the employer's representatives to see if the employers had any perceptions or beliefs about how this restriction impacted the employee outside of the workplace. Most employers are not particularly concerned with what happens if what an employee does outside the workplace. If an employee wants to smoke at home, it may not be very good for that employee, but the employer is not going to restrict them from doing that. And similar in this case, Mr. Mack had restrictions that said he couldn't squat. He was physically capable of doing so. It just wasn't advisable. Great Dane was concerned about what he did in the workplace, but outside of the workplace was no concern of theirs. If I could, Your Honor, I'd like to move to another issue that we've raised, and that is whether Mr. Mack could perform the essential functions of his job. Mr. Mack was an ATB, which is an acronym for Assistant Trailer Builder. That is the entry-level position at Great Dane. Assistant trailer builders are jacks of all trades. They do whatever they are asked to do. They are the lowest persons on the Great Dane corporate ladder.
Boy, it sounds like they ought to be on the top of the ladder if they can do anything. They're required to do anything. But there you go.
Well, that's the way most of our careers started out, I think. Mine still may be there. You are required as a Great Dane, ATB. You're not permanently assigned to any one department, any one area. All ATBs rotate among different tasks, different assignments, as needed. Great Dane makes their trailers to order. Their production demands vary given what orders they are working on. They may need ATBs in one area this week and in another area next week. There's an abundant testimony concerning the shortage of ATBs that Great Dane was experiencing during Mr. Mack's employment. This even heightened Great Dane's need to have versatile and flexible ATBs. There are numerous tasks that ATBs are assigned to perform that require the ATB to work from a squat or a kneel position. Great Dane builds these trailers from the bottom up, front to back. Axles, wheels. These are things that are close to the ground, and the employee is required to be close to the ground to work on these aspects of the trailer. If an employee cannot squat and cannot kneel, he cannot perform these functions. The very job Mr. Mack was performing the night he suffered his work-related injury is very indicative of the type of work an ATB does. He was putting scuff plates, scuff boards in trailers. These are like floorboards you have in your house. They go inside of a trailer. They're metallic bands. The entire shift, 10 hours, Mr. Mack was on his knees riveting these, drilling these metallic scuff plates onto the floor. He discusses in his own testimony the fast-paced work, the fact that Great Dane was short-handed. There were only two people doing this job. Mr. Mack testified he could not do this job in light of his restrictions. If he cannot do this job, he cannot perform the essential functions of an assistant trailer builder. I think Mr. Mack's own work experience, he's the only witness who testified who actually worked as an ATV. Great Dane presented many of his own witnesses, but Mr. Mack was the only ATV who testified. He only worked for 3 weeks, but that little snapshot, that 3 weeks of the life of an ATV, tells us everything we need to know. Mr. Mack held four or five different assignments in that three-week period. He discussed, as I've already indicated, the fact that Great Dane was a little short-handed and that these employees were being moved all the time. Mr. Mack also admitted that he could not, in light of his restrictions, wear the required steel-toed work boot with metatarsal guard. The steel-toed boot with metatarsal guard is something that is required of all Great Dane employees. Anyone who walks onto the factory floor must be wearing this safety equipment. Mr. Mack could not wear the safety equipment because of his injury. He could not perform as an ATV. Some of the other factors that we can look at to decide the essential functions of a job are what are the consequences of not asking this person to perform this function. In this case, asking Mr. Mack not to perform these functions would result in trailers not getting built, trailers being built without wheels, trailers being built without axles, without scuff plates. The tasks that Mr. Mack cannot perform because of his injury are directly related to the main purpose of Great Dane, which is building trailers. It is not as though he is restricted so he cannot sweep up the floor at the end of the shift to help clean up. His disability, his impairment, directly relates to the purposes of Great Dane trailers. Very briefly, Your Honor, I'd like to say the last factor that I'd like to discuss is the fact that Great Dane did not come to these essential functions on the eve of trial. Great Dane requires each of its employees to pass a post-job offer physical exam. This post-job offer physical exam requires the potential employee to demonstrate his or her ability to perform the very kind of tasks that Mr. Mack cannot, such as squatting, kneeling, and safe lifting of heavy objects. I'm into my rebuttal time, so if there are no further questions, I'm sure it's remaining at my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Craig. Mr. Condras.
May it please the Court. Robert Condras for Mark Mack. Judges, I believe I'd like to first address the question whether or not lifting is a major life activity by first stating that this is a case about Mr. Mack's termination. Mr. Mack is grieving the fact that he was terminated based upon Great Dane's regard of him. Whether or not he had the actual an actual disability as defined by the ADA in the major life activity of lifting was not permitted to be an issue at trial. It is this regard, and it is this mistaken belief about his abilities not to lift when in fact he could lift. It was also the basis for Great Dane's termination of him when it regarded him as someone whom I would define...
I'm not sure I understand how it's possible to have a mistaken belief about something where if the belief were true, it would not amount to a disability. And think about Sutton. Suppose United mistakenly believed that a given person who wanted to be a pilot was nearsighted. In fact, he was not nearsighted. And therefore, United wouldn't hire him as a pilot. Would he have a claim under the ADA?
I believe so.
But Sutton establishes that even if he were nearsighted, he would not have a claim under the ADA because being nearsighted is not a disability. So why would a mistaken belief that somebody had a condition that is not a disability
If the belief leads to an unlawful termination,
unlawful is that it's a mistaken belief about a disability. If the employer mistakenly believes that somebody has what amounts to a legal disability, That's the same as having that legal disability. But if you mistakenly believe that somebody can't scratch behind his right ear, and you fire him because of that, and scratching behind your being able to scratch behind your right ear is not a disability, how would the ADA preclude the employer from saying, you can't scratch behind your right ear, you're fired?
If the employer fires someone based upon its regard of his physical abilities, including this case, lifting, believing that I will otherwise have ADA liability attached to
me, let me give you another variation of this. The employer says, this is a job for which the ability to bench press 300 pounds is essential. You can bench press only 200 pounds. You cannot work this job. Is that prohibited by the ADA?
Not if the ability to bench press 300 pounds is essential to that job.
And even if we assume that the employer is mistaken, that this person can bench press 300 pounds. See, the argument you're making, and apparently persuaded the district court to, is that every mistake by an employer about what a person can do violates the ADA, even if that is not a mistake about a disability. It's just, the ADA is a universal, no mistake in employment rule. And that's, you're repeating that argument here, but I'm having, as you see, a good deal of difficulty with it as a correct statement of the ADA.
I believe lifting is a major life activity. It's addressed in the appendix.
Well,
the Code of Federal Regulations.
Let's continue on this line. Are you maintaining this position that every mistake about the employee's physical abilities violates the ADA, even if those abilities are not disabilities under the ADA?
I think that you have to go through the entire definition in part. It's a qualified individual with a disability who can perform the essential functions of the job with or without reasonable accommodation. The definition disabled is defined in three parts: actual, regarded as, or record of disability.
Yeah, but it has to be regarded as something that, if true, would be a disability.
That's correct. And
okay, so you've now abandoned the legal argument that was, I think, essential to the judgment, and we now come to the question whether what was involved here was really a disability. Is inability to lift, to squat in order to lift heavy weights from below the waist, a disability?
That was not the evidence. That is why I first addressed in my brief that credibility and weight of the evidence are the issues to review when there was a motion for judgment as a matter of law and a renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law. The testimony in this case was he was fired immediately on the day, the documentary, when it said no lifting at all, not some kind of inability to properly lift, to some of the claims that were later made at trial. There was also testimony from the person who fired my client that my client had an inability to lift. Inability means unable in terms of substantial limitations that can be defined in two ways: either unable to perform the activity or significantly restricted when compared to the average person in the general population. There was the no lifting and the unable to lift evidence. Then there was also the evidence of another person who used the ADA successfully in a dispute against Great Dane. He had the exact same injury as my client, a peroneal nerve injury that resulted in drop foot. He was also an assistant trailer builder. His name was Richard Brown. He used the ADA successfully against Great Dane. He was able to regain reinstatement in the same month that Mr. Mack was injured. Mr. Mack was always treated differently, and we had the evidence at trial that all of the actors except for one were involved in the Richard Brown litigation about the same issues. Richard Brown's injury resulted in an actual lifting restriction.
I'm not particularly worried about comparable cases. Employers often do things they're not required by law to do. Does the inability to squat in order to lift things from below the waist meet the standard of Toyota against Williams?
I do not believe that squatting is a major life activity that's listed. If it were, I would have raised that at trial, and I certainly wish that it were, because this is an employment statute.
Maybe my question just isn't clear. I'm not asking whether something is listed someplace in some regulation. I'm asking about the application of the Supreme Court standard in Toyota against Williams.
Correct. Lifting was the regarded issue in this case.
I am asking about the application of the Supreme Court's opinion in Toyota against Williams.
and I briefed that. Let's
get factual. In that Toyota case, since it was dealing with carpal tunnel syndrome, and it looked at what it, you know, the person was trying to operate at the time. I mean, the court at some length talked about the fact that she could perform major life activities. I mean, and given sort of that language and the factual scenario there, doesn't that create a problem for you here with the squatting and lifting?
I don't believe so.
And why not?
In that case, Mrs. Williams was discussing her actual, she claimed that she needed to be reasonably accommodated. She had the actual disability in the major life activity of performing manual tasks.
The Supreme Court is that she did not have a disability.
I understand that was the holding, but she claimed that she did.
I give up.
Go ahead. Try to make what the dissent. That's what I'm trying to make the dissent. You know what the Supreme Court found, and factually, given the evidence that was presented there, it's a problem for you in this case. You know, and you need to tell us why you think it doesn't apply, or if you can find some way to distinguish it, because Toyota is a problem.
In my brief, my supplemental brief, I described this is a regarded as case as compared to an actual disability
case. Right, but you've already agreed that unless the person is regarded as something that would amount to a disability, the regarded as business adds nothing. And that's what then drives us back to the question whether this is a disability.
Correct. And I am still, I wish to remain with that position. Unable to lift is substantially limiting because unable in the major life activity of lifting. To answer your question, with respect to the difference between the actual disability, Ms. Williams said, I can't do certain things that were unique to my job, but I can do certain things within the overall major life activity of performing manual tasks. Mr. Mack could lift. That was not the issue at trial. It was their regard of his inability to lift. And they used the phrase unable. I was not required at trial to get into some type of a fine distinction regarding the decision maker's regard of his ability to lift, whether it raised to that ADA disabled level with respect to their regard of him. If I may, with respect to the jack of all trades argument that has been made, that was not the evidence. In response to a request, a very specific jury instruction was given, but there was no written job description for the assistant trailer builder. The evidence that they claimed at trial that you had to be a jack of all trades was contradicted by previous deposition testimony when they claimed they did not rely at all on a written list of essential functions for that job. There was Mr. Max testimony that the things that he was restricted in, that he worked in a position where he never had to kneel or squat. And Dr. Schooler, contrary to the fact that Great Dane claims there was no mistake about, Dr. Schooler issued different reports, and I tried to issue by issue lump in examples of facts, but Dr. Schooler said that he could go back to work for more than a year before he was fired, and that was ignored. The cases cited by Great Dane involve employers who relied upon doctors who said the employee can't come back to work. But Dr. Schooler said that he could. Dr. Schooler gave conflicting reports. They sought to introduce the evidence that she was actually mistaken when she said that he couldn't lift and said that that's not what I mean. With respect to the kneeling squatting, this is the other issue that I raised. She also testified that she didn't mean that Mr. Mack could never kneel and never squat. She described it as common sense. I cited that in the brief. Great Dane sought to pick and choose Dr. Schooler's explanations of what Mr. Mack could and could not do. And I think that if she was allowed to explain some, she needed to be allowed to explain all of what she meant to explain why they made these mistakes. I have raised issues about, on cross-appeal, about punitive damages. I don't believe that without the, in terms of how to decide, how did the Great Dane management officials regard him as disabled and violate the ADA, Mr. Mack had to prove that they were lying, because the trial they came in and they made this argument. We believe that Mr. Mack was so permanently impaired that we had to fire him immediately, not try to accommodate him, not try to put him back to work, not use our own claimed multi-step return to work procedures. But we didn't quite perceive him as so disabled that ADA liability attached to us or the ADA obligation to accommodate, so on and so forth. That was contradicted by a substantial amount of evidence, including the fact that this explanation given for his termination was not in his personnel file, They claimed when they met with Mr. Mack eventually, when he asked him why he was fired, that he was only fired because of some one-year rule and that it had nothing to do with anything else. But then placed a record in they told him during this meeting, please reapply. But then this record was placed in his file that this was not somebody who was to be rehired. And this explanation continued to evolve and change over time. With the Brusso opinion, I believe that there's evidence that there were lies to cover up the discriminatory intent and that this issue should have been submitted for consideration of punitive damages. The same issue came up with respect to the workers' compensation retaliatory discharge claim. That same evidence that was used in the ADA claim existed on what's called the Frampton claim. And it's a stronger case with the untrue proffered reason or the pretext. That evidence existed. It should have been a jury question. I have submitted the evidence that I used at the summary judgment briefing stage on that issue. With respect to the attorney fee argument, I believe I cited the correct facts and the correct law about the amounts. And I would ask, with respect to this regard issue, the ADA is like most of our other employment discrimination statutes. It is difficult to get an employer to admit. It is difficult to derive direct evidence of discrimination. Normally, we need to use circumstantial evidence. The factors surrounding this termination were certainly enough that this case was submitted to the jury, and the jury had to make a credibility determination. The jury had to weigh the evidence that it had, and I believe that it correctly did so. With respect to the other issue, whether lifting is a major life activity, I do not have the case site in front of me, but my recollection is the Supreme Court has time to time questioned whether certain activities are major life activities. At one point it questioned whether the overall activity of working is. But I believe that lifting...
That's still an open issue. It was reserved again in Toyota.
And I believe that lifting has never been determined not to be a major life activity, and I believe that it was cited as an example of a major life activity in U.S. Supreme Court cases. If it would please the court, I'd be happy to do that research and resubmit that if that is going to be a factor in this case. But my case has always been built upon the Great Dane statements, unqualified statements, not cured after the impeachment testimony was used against Mr. Steed, who fired Mr. Mack, not cured at trial with other deposition. It was inability to lift. Fired the day that the no lifting statement came up, the Richard Brown evidence, the lying to Mr. Mack about the reasons that he was fired, covering up despite putting a record in his personnel file saying, do not hire this person. And that personnel record said that if you have a specific reason why you fired this gentleman, you must state why. That was left blank. These later explanations, we meant to do this, contradicted the testimony that was and the evidence that was gathered much closer in time to the Great Dane's termination of Mr. Mack, because it was a regard of disability case as opposed to actual disability, we had to go to the management people. That evidence was primarily derived from Mr. Steed and Mr. Royce, who made the decision to fire him. The jury had to decide, are we being told the truth now by the Great Dane officials as to what their reasoning was when they fired Mr. Mack? He can't lift from the floor up to his waist because of the squat issue. That was never said to Mr. Mack. That was not said in the early deposition testimony that was used to impeach Mr. Steed. That was not claimed in any of these doctor records. Dr. Schooler, the use of this claim that we didn't mistake, she was mistaken when they wanted her to be mistaken, and she was relied upon when they wanted her to be relied upon. Her explanations in her later deposition testimony were used when they thought it helped and not used when they didn't. But all of that was brought out to the jury. All of that was argued, and this was a credibility determination. And the jury, based upon what it saw of those witnesses, believed that this discriminatory animus existed, that they regarded Mr. Mack as disabled, and that they fired him because of that regard. I would ask that, I cited the Davidson case. There was a footnote. And the question, do you have to reasonably accommodate someone you only regard as disabled who is not actually disabled? And I would state that when the issue is, I'm going to discriminate against you and fire you because I regard you as disabled, and I don't want to provide you a reasonable accommodation or have any of those obligations attached to me. That is just as onerous as firing somebody because of an actual disability, maybe more so because a mistake has been made and a valuable worker has been ejected from the workplace. I thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Anything further, Mr. Craig?
Mr. Connors has discussed what he claims to be statements by Great Danes management that they perceive Mr. Mack as having an inability to lift. We have cited to the court in our briefs, page 132 through 134 of Mr. Seed's testimony. That testimony makes it very clear that Mr. Seed is only concerned about how your squatting affects your ability to lift. He used the phrase inability to lift one time, taken entirely out of context by Mr. Condris. Immediately, Mr. Steed in his testimony immediately followed his inability to lift statement with a reference to squatting. I do not believe that the testimony cited by Mr. Mack supports his belief that he was perceived as being entirely unable to lift. The essential functions of the ATB position, Mr. Mack's counsel has discussed the existence of the physical exam form, the post-job offer physical exam form. He claims that these, I'm not sure if I understood his claim to be that this thing does not exist. It certainly does exist. It's part of the, it's one of the stipulated exhibits at trial. It's part of Mr. Mack's personnel file. These are tests that Mr. Mack undertook. He testified concerning this test. He was required to pass this test in order to become employed at Great Dane. One of the tests that he was required to pass was what's called the duck walk, which requires the employee to demonstrate that he can walk in a squatted position. Frequently, these employees at Great Dane are walking under these trailers. They need to be able to walk very closely to the ground, and they are required to demonstrate this. I think that the importance of the Supreme Court's decision in Toyota with respect to major life activities is it's not necessarily what the activity is that is as important as how it affects your life. The activity could be lifting, it could be working, it could be manual actions, as in Williams, repetitive manual actions. The important factor is how it impacts one's life. There is no evidence in this case that Mr. Mack's impairment had a significant impact in his day-to-day living, in those kind of activities that are at the core of our daily lives. For that reason, his regarded as claim must fail. The punitive damage issue was correctly decided by Judge McKinney. You must show reckless indifference or malice in order to recover punitive damages in this type of case. Supreme Court's decision in Kolstad states that you don't have to necessarily show egregious conduct, but you have to show that the employer acted in the face of some perceived risk, that their actions may violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. Mr. Mack has argued that he can demonstrate that Great Dane acted in the face of a perceived risk because Great Dane's management personnel had attended seminars on the ADA and were familiar with the Americans with Disabilities Act. We believe that that standard strays too far from the Supreme Court's standard in Kolstad. Merely showing that the employer had some knowledge of the ADA does not equate with a showing that the employer acted in the face of a perceived risk. Indeed, it would act as a disincentive to employers to say that if you've gone to an ADA training seminar, you're going to be liable for punitive damages. I don't think that was the intent of the Kolstad court. The ADA is a very complicated law. It's very difficult to determine who is a member of the protected class. Questions such as what is a substantial limitation? What is an essential function? What is a reasonable accommodation? All these questions have to be answered before you even know who's a member of the protected class. Great Dane reasonably, in good faith, believed that Mr. Mack was not a member of the protected class. Therefore, a finding that they were acting in the face of a perceived risk is not possible. I would just, the court's decision in Brusso is distinguishable on these grounds. Brusso was a retaliation case. The plaintiff had complained of sexual harassment and then was later demoted. In a retaliation case, it's easy to understand who the protected class is and who you must be careful with and who you cannot discriminate against. And in Americans with Disabilities Act case, it's much more difficult. Mr. Mack has also raised his state law retaliatory discharge of Frampton claim. I think, again, we believe Judge McKinney got this one right. See, I'm...
You got a minute.
I have a minute. Thank you, Judge.
50 seconds now.
Well, I better start talking. The
45.
Proximity in time is the key factor in the Frampton case. Mr. Mack suffered a work-related injury, began receiving workers' compensation benefits within a week. 13 months later, he was terminated. This whole time period, he received workers' compensation benefits. Indeed, after he was terminated, for approximately a month, he continued to receive workers' compensation benefits. There is no proximity in time between the filing of the workers' compensation claim and the termination. Without this proximity in time, there can be no finding that he was retaliated against for filing a workers' compensation claim. And I've cited to the court as supplemental authority this court's recent decision in Farrell versus Getz.
No.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.